From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1997 when Hollywood put out a movie called Contact, and it seemed far-flung at the time, this notion of contact with intelligent life, outer space. And think about it, that was 20 years ago. It was a long time ago, right? Not really that long. Actually, in planet life terms, it was nothing. It was an eyelash. And yet, at the time, the experts in the room tell me that we knew of no known exoplanets. Nothing in 20 years ago. Now, we know of 3,400 of them, and they're starting to pile up. And listen to this. February 22nd, NASA announced they had discovered the future home for Earthlings. Okay, maybe not. But anyway, they announced a fascinating number of discoveries that day. First of all, they had discovered not just one Earth-like planet orbiting a star or Earth size, but seven. Seven possible planets to harbor life. And hey, if they're not already harboring life, maybe we can pack up and move there after our climate makes Earth not so much fun for us. Here's another fascinating thing. The star is about 40 light years away, reasonably close in galaxy terms. We'll talk about that. And here's another. The way these seven planets are situated gives us a pretty good vantage point to study them. The star is a dwarf star named TRAPPIST-1. At least one or more of the planets could be at the right temperature to have water, and I mean like lots of water, like oceans of water. Astronomer Michael Gillen said, quote, "This is the first time so many planets of this kind are found around the same star," end quote. All of which leads to some more interesting questions. How long would it take to travel 40 light years? Could we ever get there in a human lifetime? Is it a good idea to look for possible future homes considering the course of our planet and climate? And 1997 was Contact? I mean, that time moves really quickly, I guess. Let me welcome our guest for the hour. Brian Koberline is the Senior Lecturer of Physics at RIT. Always good to have you. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you for having me again.
And Roger Duby is a Research Professor and Director of the Science Exploration Program at RIT. Roger, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Good to be here.
That was a quick edit to the intro, by the way, thanks to Rob Braden, Megan Mack, and Brian and Roger, because I didn't know that 20 years ago when Contact came out, Brian, you were just saying before we started,
We didn't even know
of exoplanets, really.
Yeah, I think there may have been one around something like a pulsar that they had found in 92, but none around main sequence stars, so none of them that even remotely would be Earth-like.
We have come a long way
since
that movie came out.
Yeah.
And, you know, the funny thing about that movie is, you know, I don't know if funny is the right word. Interesting. I mean, was it ridiculous to you? Do you remember Contact much, Brian?
Oh, I remember Contact a lot, yeah. I even showed it in astronomy class, to which, you know, I thought it might inspire them, and their only response was, "Matthew McConaughey is a hottie," which is true, but, you know, I mean, it wasn't really what I was going for.
Yeah, I gotcha. Well, you'd be a cool professor to have. I want one of your classes. Roger, we have come a long way in 20 years, haven't we? What does this discovery of TRAPPIST mean to you?
So the primary significance of TRAPPIST is that we now have a well-established planetary system around a star where we've got several candidates for the possible appearance and evolution of life. This is not what we've been seeing up to date. We typically see a large Jupiter-like planet around a star and then some smaller ones. These are seven of them that are Earth size, and so the gravity is potentially correct. At least three of those are in what's called the Goldilocks zone, which is the range of distance from the star where water is still liquid. It's not too hot. It's not too cold.
So, again, we hear water, and I think of Mars or little drops of or frozen pyramids on what was that one? Not, I would say Xerxes. What was there was some, oh man, this is where my research has failed me. But the bottom line is, when we talk about water in some of these planets, we're talking about little traces or just little bits. You're talking about, and the scientists that NASA brought forth a month ago were talking about potential oceans?
Yes, absolutely. Right. There's been a big change in the technology that we've been using since Contact. Contact was written at a time when radio astronomy was the primary way for us to search for exoplanets. There's a famous equation called the Drake equation, written by Frank Drake, that basically calculated the probability of finding an intelligent civilization that had developed radio capability. Well, radio is actually a very narrow constraint to place on other civilizations around other planets. What we've done since then is we've put telescopes in space. And by doing that, by getting above the Earth's atmosphere, we've now been able to look at spectral features of molecules. And we can find a signature for a water molecule going on a planet going around a star. And that has just caused this explosion in the number of potential life-supporting planets around other stars.
Frank Drake was like the coolest cat. This was in the 1960s, and he just decides, I'm going to put a number on the likelihood that there are other intelligent civilizations out there, knowing how primitive it was to even try to do that at the time. And he's still with us today. I think he's in his mid to upper 80s, but I mean, you still see occasional talks given by Frank Drake. And it's fun to see exactly what Roger's talking about, how much technology has brought us closer. You know, Brian Koberline was saying before the hour began that 40 light years is sort of super far away and super close. Can you explain that?
Well, I mean, a light year is an extraordinarily long distance. You know, I think the, you know, if you look at the distance to the moon, that is how far light travels in about a second. Just a single second is all the way to the moon. And our solar system, if you go to Mars, that's on the order of an hour or minutes. And so when you're talking about something for which light takes years to travel, it's an immense distance. But our galaxy is so huge that 40 light years is only 10 times more distant than the very closest star other than our sun, Proxima Centauri. And so in the scheme of our galaxy, that's actually a pretty close distance.
The analogy that the guys were using before the hour began, and we'll see how if I'm reading this right, is you talk about going to like Centauri B, and it's going from Rochester to New York City. Now we're talking about going from Rochester to California, which in the horse and wagon days, as Louis C.K. once said, you could do it. It'd be 30 years, and half your family would be dead by the time you get there. But you could maybe do it. The question is, could we eventually, you know, is it even cynical to think that we could even dream of getting 40 light years in a human lifetime? It just seems impossible. Brian, you don't think it's impossible?
Well, I didn't say that. I think, you know, in a human lifetime, that's, you know, a lot faster than we could ever imagine. But if you think of something like Breakthrough Starshot, which is trying to send something to Proxima Centauri in, I think, 70 years or something, that's trying to get up to a few percent of the speed of light. If you could send a small probe at 10% of the speed of light, it would take 400 years to get to this star system. Oh. So we would really have to think on the scale of centuries.
Okay, but it's important to note that right now we're looking at this problem from the perspective of the horse and wagon situation. Back in the horse and wagon days, the idea of getting to California in a matter of 2 or 3 days was outrageous.
Or 4 hours by plane.
Inconceivable. Mm-hmm. 4 hours by plane. Inconceivable. Magic had to happen. And so these breakthrough technologies continue to occur, and there's really no way for us to foresee how we're going to be able to achieve this, but it's not inconceivable.
All right, well, thank you, Roger, because I'm looking at the clock going, I got 45 minutes to fill with these guys, and you just killed the dream. So you have nothing to talk about. But now we do. No, I joke, because I think Roger's right. I mean, imagine talking to the horse and wagon folks. Imagine that, and imagine telling them not just that you could go from Rochester to California in 5 hours or 4 hours on a plane, but that we would be able to get to the moon and come back. I mean, it's just not within the human imagination. And so, yes, eventually someone will dig up this recording, look back at me, and laugh at being skeptical that we could ever get there. But there's a long way to go. So let me ask both of you the next broad question that a lot of people had out of this, which is, should we be looking at this kind of discovery, TRAPPIST, this star with seven planets that are roughly Earth-like, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. Should we be looking at TRAPPIST with any enthusiasm as a potential home? Is that ridiculous? Should we be looking for potential homes in the stars just in case we really can't grow up and make this one more habitable? I'll start with you, Roger. I mean, is that a silly question to even be pursuing?
Well, again, using the horse and buggy analogy, yes, it seems silly. However, there are a variety of ways that we could short-circuit that limitation. It's not inconceivable to think that if another civilization has evolved on one of these planets, And if we can develop a way to communicate with them at the speed of light, that's not too bad. That's 40 years one way for a communication. Granted, that seems crazily slow. However, if they've evolved sufficiently and they've developed faster than light travel, some other
way. If they're ahead of us?
If they're way ahead of us in terms of space
then
travel.
Then we're lunch, dude.
They can they can send us the blueprint. And all of a sudden, and we can do it, we can do a trade. It's like, okay, we'll show you all the things that we've developed. You show us the things you've developed.
You're
and all of a sudden, we've got two civilizations that are sort of cooperating.
I love this.
In trying to expand and become more galactic.
They have to be benevolent and not consider us to be lunch.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Right. Absolutely.
But you would hope that if they are evolved and advanced, that they would be fascinated to know that we're out there.
Of course.
They might be up there, you know, with Fermi's paradox doing the same thing. Where is everybody? And we
right.
may be the ones saying, we're right here, guys.
Yeah.
You know, what do you
right.
think, Brian?
Well, I agree. I think it's one of the interesting things about the TRAPPIST discovery is, in many ways, it's probably a much more common solar system than our own. A star our size is in the top 5% of stars in terms of mass. So it's actually relatively rare. Only 1 in 20 have the mass of our sun. And red dwarfs, which this is a small red dwarf, are 75% of stars in our galaxy. So it is far more likely to find potentially habitable planets around red dwarfs than it is around anything else.
Well, and in this case, as we look at TRAPPIST, again, it's 40 light years away, and seven planets that we know about, at least three maybe in the Goldilocks zone, as Roger said. Here's a kind of an ignorant question, forgive me. Do we know already that there's no life that's at least emitting anything? How would we get to a point where we could say, hey, there might not only be life there, but there's something serious going on there? What would that take?
Well, it's going to take more observation of what these planets are. So right now, what we know is we know the planets are there. We know what their orbits are. We know their mass, and we know their size. So we know things like how dense they are and that, in fact, they are Earth-like in size and mass and density. The next thing is to look at, as these stars pass in front of the star, just like what Roger was talking about, looking at, do they have atmospheres? If they have atmospheres, some of that light is going to be absorbed by the star when it passes in front of the star, and we'll be able to tell. Does it have water vapor in an atmosphere? Does it have oxygen in an atmosphere? Those are the types of things that we could look at as signatures of life on that planet.
Okay. And we're looking for just signatures?
Well, that's going to be one of the things that we'll look at. I mean, you can look for radio signals. We haven't found anything yet.
Yeah.
But, you know, they would kind of have to be intentionally sending to us for us to be able to pick up something like that.
Some signatures are more specific to the existence of life than others. So, for example, methane gas is a gas that typically doesn't appear on a planet or in an atmosphere unless there's a biological source. There's an organism that's busy metabolizing some of the molecules around it and emitting methane gas as a byproduct, as an unpleasant thing that it doesn't want. Methane gas has a very nice spectral signature that we can see. And so looking for signatures like that that are unique indicators of the possible existence of life is an important exercise. And we're busy mounting a variety of research programs on that now.
We've talked about a number of different interesting discoveries, not the least of which was Tabby's star, Tabitha Boyajian, from Yale. And I think it was 15 light years away. Megan Mack's going to check for me in just a second to Tabby's star, which, of course, is surrounded by an alien megastructure. Well, I say, of course, probably not surrounded by an alien megastructure, but we still don't know. And there's a lot of study ahead for Tabby's star. Clearly, not 15 light years, 1,500 light years. Okay, so that's actually, thank you, Megan. And that just shows you how vast space is. Because when Tabby's star was discovered, and you've got this strange thing orbiting it that looks like it might be a Dyson sphere or a Dyson swarm, which is, I'm not going to bore you, but just Google that and have some fun for about a couple of hours. Maybe an alien megastructure that could be decayed or, you know, gone or active, who knows. And they were going, well, that's not that far away, 1,500 light years.
Yeah.
What we're talking about with TRAPPIST is just 40 light years. So, again, Brian, every time I start looking up numbers, my brain just starts to melt.
Yeah, I mean, you have to keep in mind, as an astronomer, we think of, you know, a million years is a short time, and a thousand light years is a short distance, because our galaxy is 100,000 light years across. So, well, it's 1,000 light years. That's just in our corner of the galaxy. It's not even to the other galaxies millions or billions of light years away.
Yeah. Right. 10 to the ninth is kind of the scale that astronomers typically use.
That's what I used to use.
And so
10 to the eighth usually. Is what
things that are down to 10 to the sixth, it's like, oh, my God, that's incredibly close.
This is such a geek hour right here. I don't even know what Roger just said. So, big numbers. Right. We're talking about the TRAPPIST system 40 light years away. Seven planets around it, and let's talk about what it would require to really make those things habitable. I think both of our guests pointed something out before the hour began that is really interesting to me that we should talk about, which is the fact that Earth is small and our moon is huge.
Yes.
So, and let's talk about exactly that, because we don't really have a scale of small. To us, Earth is Earth. But Earth is pretty small. Brian?
Well, I mean, it's small compared to Jupiter or Saturn. It's not a gas planet. It's a small rocky planet around a star. And most rocky planets that we have either have no moons. So Venus and Mercury has no moon. Mars has two small moons that are captured asteroids. And then you have Earth, and Earth has this massive moon. Our moon is as large as the moons orbiting Jupiter, which is the largest planet in our solar system. So we basically have the type of moon that would orbit a large gas planet around a small rocky planet. And that has a significant effect to life on Earth and, you know, the geology of Earth, because it creates tidal effects, it keeps our internal warm, it creates water flow that goes back and forth across the beaches and everything.
If the moon were half its size, what would that mean for us?
We'd have less tidal effects. Mm-hmm. We'd probably, our core, we'd be less geologically active probably. Our volcanic activity would probably be less.
Probably the time frame of evolution would be longer.
Yeah.
The moon has created this twice a day tide that tosses everything in the ocean up onto the rocks, and then the tide recedes, and these poor little things that might be out there suddenly have to deal with the fact that they're no longer in that nice, warm, fuzzy ocean. And so that forces these organisms, as they appear, to learn to deal with that. And they become more and more able to survive on land. And then you start getting evolution that pushes them and makes them become land-capable plants. You end up with land animals and so on. So it's a very strong force for evolution. But to the extent that you reduce or remove the moon, you slow that rate way, way down. Now it's going to be just the wind that's going to cause these things to happen at the beach, but that's not anywhere near as dramatic as a big tide.
And when it comes to evaluating life and how life evolves and the kinds of life, in our second half hour, we're going to dive in with Roger especially on some really mind-blowing stuff that is happening as we learn to evaluate what kind of life might be out there. But let's stay with TRAPPIST. Seven planets. They're all rocky-ish, Earth-like, we think?
They're probably all rocky-ish. They are anywhere from about half the mass of Earth to, I think, 1.1 times the mass of Earth. And they are comparably the same type of size. They're a little bit less dense than Earth.
But TRAPPIST, the star, is small, much smaller than our sun. So what does that mean? What does that mean for the planets orbiting?
Well, it's a very small red dwarf, and so it has about 80 times the mass of Jupiter. It's about 10% the mass of our sun, but because of all of the gravitational weight, it's only about the size of Jupiter. So these planets actually orbit very close to the star. They're about, you know, their orbits are the order of days. I think the farthest one is 20-day orbit. So it's about the, you know, the speed of our moon, basically.
Fast years,
yeah. Those years are on the order of days. And because it's so small, it's not very bright in the visible spectrum. So if there were life on one of these planets, if we were to land there, it would look kind of like dusk on Earth, you know, just before sunset. It would be very dim. But it would be as warm as a sunny day on Earth, because most of the light that this star gives off is infrared, not in the visible. So it gives off a lot of heat, but not as much light.
Fascinating. So Do we have a sense for, out of those seven, which ones would be in a better position, you know, closer or farther away?
I think it's planets 4, 5, and 6.
That they have better hope for?
That's right. Yeah.
Hoping that there would be water for an ocean, those kind of things.
Right.
Which, again, is sort of a human-centric view of things. We're assuming that because we're water-based, the type of things we're looking for in the universe are also going to be water-based. There's no a priori reason that that's true, but water is a very good mechanism for transporting things, and we know that it works here. So we have an existence proof that says, yep, we see that it's been done here. We know that that works. It could be something else. You know, it might be some other carrier that we're not familiar with.
Brian wrote for Forbes.com that, quote, while we know the size of these planets is similar to Earth, we don't know their mass. We also have no data on whether they have atmospheres or if they are wet or dry. All of this affects their potential habitability. But how do we make some educated guesses? Atmospheres is key. We were saying before the hour began as well that Earth is pretty cool because you can walk outside under the sky, breathe, and not die, which right. seems like a really good thing for life. And we don't really know of that existing elsewhere. But what can we start to guess about the atmospheres, Brian?
Well, we know kind of from their size and basically the type of atmosphere they might have. So if you get much more massive than the Earth, if you get into kind of what they call super Earth size, basically you start to get a thick enough atmosphere that would be more like a gas planet. If you get too much smaller than Earth, you kind of get a trace atmosphere, if at all. One of the big challenges is these are very close to a red dwarf, and red dwarfs can be very active stars at times. And so the question is,
what does that mean?
Well, they can give off solar flares, and there's X-rays and all sorts of things that can kind of push atmosphere away from a planet. And so one of the questions is, can they actually hold on to an atmosphere as they're forming and the red dwarfs are in their active period? One of the ways that can happen is if you have a strong enough magnetic field. So if your planet has a strong magnetic field, you can hold on to an atmosphere. Mars is a good example of this. Mars doesn't have a strong magnetic field, and so it doesn't hold on to its atmosphere. And so even if we terraformed Mars, we'd probably have to create some type of artificial magnetic field in order to allow it to keep its atmosphere over thousands of years.
Well, Brian's colleague, Ethan Siegel, also writing for Forbes.com, wrote the following, and then Brian and Roger added something about a moon here. But let me read from Ethan's piece, and we'll continue this here. Quote, in order to be habitable, at least habitable like Earth is, a world needs to be at the right distance from its star, of the right mass, with the right atmosphere, and with the right amount of liquid water on its surface. And our guests added, a moon would be good. If Mars had a bigger moon, or at least a proportional Earth-sized moon, would it have a better chance in a magnetic field?
I would think so. It would be more geologically active. And
yeah.
So, all right. So Roger, the big reason we want a moon is for what?
The primary reason that we want, well, there are two reasons. The moon, by making a planet more geologically active, can cause the magnetosphere inside the planet to spin, which creates a magnetic field that can be sustained. And it provides tidal forces that can cause this continual sloshing of wet environment onto dry.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
To speed things up.
Okay, and that magnetic field
also stimulates vulcanism, which brings the kind of materials that we want from the interior out to the surface.
Okay. And so those are the conditions laid out. So in a moment, our guests are going to kind of continue as we look at some of those conditions here. But let me grab a phone call. Malcolm in Rochester is first up on the phones. Go ahead, Malcolm.
Well, two things I'd like to say. First of all, this isn't a theoretical discussion in the following sense. Carbon dioxide you can argue about, but astronomers are absolutely certain that in the order of 3 billion years, it'll be so hot on Earth that we can't survive. The sun, as it burns up its hydrogen, has to increase its central temperature to produce energy with less hydrogen fuel and the presence of helium. And so we're going to have to leave and find something congenial to settle on. And the other thing is we get fooled by units. You are sitting on Earth, and if I drop a baseball, it drops at an acceleration of 32 feet per second per second. And if you put that in astronomical terms, that, if I remember right, is 1.2 light years per year per year. And if you do the Einstein calculations, it would take us 4.7 years to get to those seven planets. The only problem is I don't think you can afford the ticket, because the amount of fuel you'd need would be tremendous.
That's why we need a Dyson sphere.
I include the time it would take to stop so that we slowed down so we could land. That's just a one-way trip shooting past at a good fraction of the speed of light. Thank you for my opportunity to discuss this.
Well, thank you, Malcolm. I appreciate that phone call. I am all for taking the long view. Our listeners know that I'm almost constantly invoking us to really try to take a long view. 3 billion years, though, feels like a long, long view. I mean, we're going to be gone in 3 billion years. That is true, right?
Yeah,
probably.
Sure. Maybe. So, yeah, Malcolm, look, I'm down with the long view there. I mean, certainly this is not sustainable for 3 billion years. But, you know, it'd be better if we could preserve it for, I don't know, 3 million years, 300,000 years.
I think it raises an interesting point, because he's right in that, you know, our sun has about 5 billion more years until it's gone. It's going to become a red giant. Earth is going to become uninhabitable in about 2 billion years or so. But red dwarfs like TRAPPIST are having a very different path. They, because they're smaller, they don't use their fuel as fast. So TRAPPIST could continue burning for trillions of years, not billions, but trillions of years.
Wow.
So long after our sun is gone, TRAPPIST could still be there. Those planets could still be there. And even if evolution takes much slower on these planets to arrive, they have lots of time.
Well, the question on the atmosphere and solar flares is similar to what we heard with Proxima B, which is that, you know, that's 4 light years away. And even if you can get there, is it a safe place to be? Roger, is this the same kind of answer when I ask you, do we have any way to control the atmospheric situation in a volatile place like that to live there? Is your answer going to be, hey, you're asking the guy with the horse and buggy if we're ever going to be able to fly to the moon? It's too early to say.
Well, we know what the problem is, so that's already a step forward. here in our solar system, we see what we call coronal mass ejections, where the sun emits this high-energy burst of particles into the interplanetary region. If it sweeps past a planet, those high-energy particles can just take a whole bunch of that planet's atmosphere with it. The protection, however, is this planet's magnetic field, which we talked about before. This coronal mass ejection is typically, these are typically charged particles. They're protons and electrons. And so if the planet has a strong magnetic field, it tends to deflect and protect the atmosphere of the planet so that it's not as susceptible for the atmosphere being swept away. So we know that magnetic field is key to protecting that atmosphere.
But we can't create one artificially.
We
have them on the drawing board.
What?
There is even one proposed for Mars.
We have two for Mars.
Wait, is this using nuclear weapons or no?
No.
No, this is terraforming.
That's terraforming.
That's terraforming. Okay.
There's an interesting side thing in that there's a proposal to create a magnetic field generator that would orbit Mars and protect its atmosphere. And if you watch the TV series Expanse, they've pointed out that you can actually see the animations of these magnetic generators in the movie, in the TV show.
Do you realize what we're talking about here? If I take down a part of sheetrock in my kitchen, I have a hard enough time just kind of rebuilding it and making it sort of functional. And you got people just building models to create magnetic fields on other planets.
Yeah.
This is not an equal society of people.
Some people like to think big.
I am not really pulling my weight here.
And we haven't even touched Dyson spheres yet.
Yeah.
We haven't even gotten there yet.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Brian Koberline and Roger Dubey are here from RIT, and we're going to get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back and talk about how to figure out what kind of life you might be looking at Roger has some fascinating things going on with students in RIT's science exploration program, things that, frankly, I had never heard about. And you can tell this is sort of my geek zone. I love this stuff. But I can't wait to hear more about what Roger and the students are doing. So let's get our only break of the hour. And we'll come back. If, by the way, if you've got any questions about this, our future home for Earthlings, or where we're going next, or interspace travel and more, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Who else would you invite? The guy with the coolest glasses in Rochester, who's not wearing them today, by the way. The coolest glasses in Rochester and the first guy I knew with a Tesla. They're going to solve all these problems when we come back.
There we go.
I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, there's been a lot of armchair psychology looking at President Donald Trump. But is there a danger in trying to psychoanalyze someone without getting close to them? What can we really learn about the president? And do we do it to people in our own lives? We talk about it first hour. Then in our second hour, the Rochester Association of Black Journalists has produced a documentary and a children's book series called Rochester Legends. We'll talk to Dr. Walter Cooper and more. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So, Roger Doobie, you've got students doing what at RIT?
So, in science exploration, the students know that they love science, but they haven't really decided what they want to major in yet. And so what we do is we throw them into a hands-on laboratory environment where they get to try out all of the sciences in order to solve a big problem. And what we do in the program is try to give them problems that are really significant for mankind. And so one of the problems I gave my students in the past 2 years was, last year I asked them, recreate the conditions on early Mars and tell me whether or not life would appear there in an experiment. Then this year we took that same basic approach and then asked the broader question, under what conditions will life appear around an exoplanet? And what I mean by that is, vary the content of the atmosphere, vary the content of the ocean. Let's worry about the atmospheric pressure, how much ultraviolet light is hitting the planet. Any variables that we can put our hands on, let's change them and see what it takes to recreate those conditions and see whether or not we start to see the building blocks of life.
How? How are you doing that?
Well, that was their problem. You give them the goal and you let them figure out how to do it.
How have they done?
Fantastically. So one of the things that we have to recognize is that by the time somebody has entered college and knows that they love science, they already have the ability to do science. They've learned how to do critical thinking. They've learned how to use research tools. They know that there are all sorts of analytical equipment available on campus to use for experiments. And now you give them something that's tantalizing. It's like, wow. Let's go ahead and see how big the Goldilocks zone can be. Under what conditions do we see things appearing? And do we actually see amino acids and proteins forming? We provide them with the challenge. I have a modest budget to allow them to design and build instrumentation. And what they've done is they've created an experimental environment where they can change exactly those parameters. They can change the ocean content, the spectral content of the star. They can change the atmospheric content, lots of methane gas perhaps, or maybe a lot of CO2, variety of things like that that they can change. And they can change the evaporation condensation cycle. All of these things are things that they have built into their experiment because they thought, well, this is going to be important for us to be able to see whether or not we see anything.
Hold on a second here. I just want to say, if you're waiting on the phone, William and Kurt on the phone, they've got great questions. We're going to get to both of you in a second. I've got to continue with this. Where are the students doing this exactly, Roger?
So this is in the College of Science at RIT. And they
in a laboratory.
We have a dedicated laboratory that the university has been generous enough to assign us for a period of time. And that means that the experiment runs 24/7. So they set it up. And it's not going to be touched by any other class that might come in because no other classes have access to that room. That's important for safety reasons also because we have ultraviolet light busy breaking the molecular bonds in the atmosphere of these exoplanets that we're recreating here in the lab.
What else do you need to see happen, or what are you hoping to learn as you keep going forward with this, Roger?
Well, that's exactly the next question that I had to ask the students. So they set these things up, and they started changing parameters. And lo and behold, within about a week of running their experiment, the ocean started turning a dark purplish brown. And so I held up a flask of this stuff. I said, okay, this is good. It's interesting. What's in here? What do we look for? How do we know that this is valuable? How can we say anything meaningful about this? And so they had to say, well, we can look to see if there are sugars, amino acids, proteins. And so they looked, did a bunch of research, talked to some professors in the various disciplines at RIT, and found out the different types of tests that they can use to identify certain types of molecules that are interesting building blocks for life. And sure enough, they found carbohydrates, sugars, they found amino acids, they found proteins. All of these things appeared. And that's a good first step. Then the next question is, that's good, but are these biologically active? And the answer to that question depends on what's called chirality. So if you think of a DNA molecule, it has sort of a chiral or twist structure to it. It turns out that amino acids and proteins, in order to be biologically active, need to have this chirality to them. And so I asked the students, how are you going to tell whether or not what you're producing has chirality? So they had to do that research, and they found out, oh, a polarimeter will tell us whether or not the molecules have chirality. We got a polarimeter. Bingo. They started getting both left-hand and right-handed chiral amino acids, which is very exciting, because Earth is dominated by left-handed chiral amino acids with not much in the way of right-handed. And yet they were getting 50-50 left-handed and right-handed molecules.
Okay.
There's a lot of
drinking out of a fire hose here.
Yeah,
sorry.
Let me just back up and just ask one more question before we go to the phones because, well, I got a little bit more. So please, Kurt and William, hang in there. When we think about the so-called great filter that prevents life from becoming complex life. Well, the only complex life that we know about is us. I assume there's a lot more out there because I have the self-awareness to know it's a big universe. There's lots of Earth-like and, you know, situations out there. But what we don't know is when singular cellular stuff, microbial stuff, turns into the kind of life that wants to know if you want to go down to the Berkshires for the weekend. How do we get there? And is chirality related to that?
Yes, in the sense that chirality is necessary for life to be able to evolve to simple organisms and then more complex. So it's kind of like you're not going to have any buildings unless you have bricks.
Right.
So do we have bricks? And that's the question that we can answer right now.
And is left-right chirality related to that?
Critical. Okay. Absolutely critical. Without the left or right-handed chirality, these are not biologically active. And therefore, you're not going to see, interesting strands of proteins appearing and things like that. And so DNA doesn't have a ghost of a chance if there's not left and right chirality.
What do you make of all of this, Brian?
Oh, I agree. I mean, I think that chirality is interesting because it's kind of like Lego blocks versus some knockoff that has a different size to it.
Yeah, and I've got lots of experience with those. They're no good.
But the idea that on Earth, we adopted one type of chirality for our proteins and sugars, and because of that, we can kind of optimize our chemistry, our biochemistry is optimized to that chirality. It doesn't work with the other one. And so as soon as you start taking down the evolutionary path, it looks like that you start using one over the other. You prefer one building block over the other. So it's important to have that. Non-biological processes tend to have that kind of 50-50 split.
Mm. Wow. And now, Roger, the broad question on how to apply this. Eventually, you want to be able to look to the stars and start determining what, how.
Yes, so I talked earlier about spectral signatures. That is clearly the mechanism by which we can begin to look for the type of more advanced and complex signature that would suggest evolved organisms appearing on that planet, not just methane gas.
What would it look like?
The spectral signature or
yeah,
the life?
Yeah. Well, not the life. I don't think you can answer that one. The spectral signature.
So the spectral signature is a sort of complex pattern of bumps and dips as a function of wavelength that is unique for a particular type of molecule. And so a particular type of amino acid, let's say lysine, has a spectral signature that is well established and understood. The left and right-handed chirality can be extracted in some cases from that signature. And so as we develop more advanced capabilities in the spectral range, we should be able to begin to extract these spectral signatures from the planets that are around TRAPPIST-1.
Yeah, we've come a long way since Frank Drake.
Well, and a quick side note to that is there's a professor at MIT named Sarah Seeger who has actually developed a complementary set of equations to the Drake equation, and that's the Seeger equation. And the Seeger equation doesn't use radios or radio astronomy in the way that Frank did. Sarah has done the calculation based on spectral signature, something that we can actually use with our space-based telescopes. And so her equations for calculating the probability of finding exoplanets and finding life is actually much better suited to what we're doing today than what Frank's original vision was.
All right, well, we've got some really good listener questions queued up, both written in email and on Twitter, but I'm going to start on the phones. William in Rochester first. Go ahead, William.
I challenge the assertion that to have an atmosphere requires a magnetic field. I agree the Earth has a magnetic field and does have an atmosphere. But Venus, it has a 90 bar atmosphere, and it has very minimal magnetic field, and it's closer to the sun. It's retained its atmosphere.
Well, thank you, William. Let's see what our guests have to say about that. Go ahead.
Well, that's true to a point. The catch is that for the sun, it has our planets are farther away, and the things of solar flares and coronal mass ejections and X-rays are less damaging to an atmosphere than it would be to a very close star to a red dwarf.
Like TRAPPIST.
Right, TRAPPIST. These planets are extraordinarily close. They're much closer than Mercury, for example. And so those types of effects would likely put more stress or more strain on the ability to hold an atmosphere.
Okay. Thank you for the phone call, William. Kurt in Brockport wanted to ask, is the acceleration and temperature of the sun going to impact climate change?
To some degree, but not as much as human-caused carbon dioxide.
Yes, right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I agree completely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Steven says, who's to say that in 3 billion years we won't have the technology to save our sun?
Absolutely true.
Come on. Roger, you have to draw the line somewhere.
No, actually, you don't want to do that because that's self-limiting. You don't want to do that.
Save the sun, though?
Whenever a scientist says it's possible, they're probably right. When they say it's impossible, they're probably wrong.
Okay. Well, you know what? Again, someone's going to pull this tape somewhere. When connections, you know, whatever the year is, and they will look back and laugh at my skepticism about that. Here's an email from a listener who says, I like this idea. If it takes so long to get to another planet, by the time we get there, there will already be people there, since while we are traveling, other people will make faster methods of travel. Wouldn't that be interesting? I start off on like a 50-year journey, and by 25 years in, we build like a machine that can get there in 10 years, and they pass us on the way?
Yes.
That would be a bummer.
Our own civilization leapfrogs us on the way to this other planet. Yes,
that would be a bummer.
Absolutely conceivable. Yeah.
That would be a bummer. Brian, again, you're just going to tell me, yep, sure, that could happen.
Yeah, I mean, if you think of, you know, the idea of a generation ship that may take thousands of years to reach a star system, and we build one of these giant ships and send them off on their way, and then 100 years later, we discover warp drive and actually get to the star, build a civilization, and then await the arrival of these poor saps that have been frozen for 1,000 years.
Alex writes to us and says, sorry, Evan, but way too much focus on finding our future home, not enough focus on preserving the planet we have. Thank you, Alex. That's certainly fair. I mean, some of this is just fun this hour. I mean, science to me is amazing. I just trying to get my brain around what Brian and Roger have been talking about is great fun. But I take the point. I mean, here's one thing that I bet you even Roger Doobie would agree with. We've got a better chance of making good adjustments to an already livable planet and being adults here than figuring out how to get to and habitate on a different planet. True or false, Roger?
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Brian?
I agree. I think people, we should keep in mind that if we talk about exploring other planets or colonizing other planets, it's not Earth or, it's Earth and. All of the challenges for colonization and terraforming also apply to Earth. If we can go to Mars and live there, we can stay here on Earth and live here too.
I think that was your message right around the time that Interstellar came out. And I, by the way, I haven't seen any wormholes popping up anywhere around here in
None
the neighborhood.
Yet.
Not that we know of. A few minutes left here, and so let me start to close the conversation with this idea here. We've been talking about TRAPPIST-1, which is roughly 40 light years away. NASA announced this this discovery last month. And there are 7 planets surrounding this star, small star, red dwarf, maybe a few of them within the Goldilocks zone, but 7 planets, all roughly Earth size. So who knows if there's life there already in any form, and who knows if we could ever get there. But 40 light years away is not 1,500 light years away, which is Tabby Star or something else. And it makes me wonder, given how much we've been able to see, how many exoplanets we've been able to find, Should we really be focused a lot closer to us? I mean, and are we focused, for lack of a better phrase, closer to us because we don't have to get so far flung? There's so much reasonably close to us, Brian?
Yeah, I think so. I think part of the thing that's happened is our ability to find planets around other stars has really been limited by our ability to detect them, not their actual presence. So as our technology has advanced, we've been able to find planets around smaller stars. We've been able to find more small planets than just large planets, because those are harder to find. And as our technology advances, we will find more and more Earth-like planets around stars that are potentially habitable.
Okay, Roger?
That's clearly the direction I think that everyone's thinking these days. The focus on Mars, for example, it's achievable. It's achievable in a very short time frame to actually set up a colony there. The problems are pretty easy to identify. We know what they will be. We know what we think it's going to take to be able to grow food on Mars. We are certainly continuing an active search for hidden reservoirs of water, which will make or break a colony on Mars. And these types of problems are engineering tasks of the nature that we had with the moon missions. We had a big problem to solve. We did it, and the technological benefit, this cornucopia of new technologies that came out of the moon program, we might expect to see come out of the Mars program as well.
Is Mars still worth all of the investment to you, Roger?
Worth. I'm trying to understand that term in this context.
Look, I'm somebody who I love the exploration and the knowledge that we gain, but I still think we have to look at it as, you know, there are limited budgets. We don't have unlimited budgets. We can't do everything we want to do with space exploration, all the different work that NASA would have to be doing. What I mean by worth is this. When you look at the discovery of TRAPPIST, when you think about Proxima B and you think about what might be out there, what we're learning about, and the efforts to ever learn how to get there and what we might do there or learn from it, is it worth the resources that we might use on other efforts to spend it on Mars? That you're talking about growing food there, but it still feels like a pipe dream. And again, maybe I'm too limited in my imagination. Is it worth those resources, or should those resources go elsewhere?
So this is really a business question.
Yeah.
This is really return on investment. With the moon, we didn't, the return on investment from the moon was largely the technology benefits that came from that program. With Mars, we've got a different situation. We not only have challenges for whole new technologies such as terraforming, but we also have an entire planet of resources that are potentially valuable to us. Things that may be of great interest, rare metals, for example, that we're having trouble finding on Earth and are very limited supply, could potentially be in abundance on Mars, and then all of a sudden the Mars colony can simply do trade, have a mining activity on Mars for a particular rare metal, ship it back to Earth on one of these SpaceX robot ships, and in exchange get some benefit back, you know, some more technology, some more seeds for food, et cetera. So it can become, in principle, a thriving business enterprise.
All right, Brian, what would be your priority if you're running NASA? Where's the money going?
I don't know. That
would you be going
that.
Back to the moon like some of Trump's advisors have said we should be doing?
I think it would be worthwhile to go back to the moon. I think just because that's a stepping stone to where we want to go further. But, I mean, I think that Mars definitely has value. I mean, in the sense that not only do we have another world that we can live on, but its gravity is less. It's easier to launch rockets from. It is more accessible to the asteroid belt. If we want to mine asteroids, a colony on Mars is going to be a place to do it from. So there are definitely financial motivations as well as just the pure science exploring the universe.
All right. Well, and by the way, the frozen pyramids that I was talking about was on a dwarf planet, Ceres. C-E-R-E-S.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I always got the names wrong. And it wasn't actually frozen, I don't think. I think it turned out not to be water anyway.
I think it was salt.
Okay.
The bright spots.
I
wouldn't
spots.
Call them pyramids. That sounds artificial. But
yeah,
they were bright spots on Ceres.
Pyramids sound like the Ceresians built pyramids a long time ago, which we don't know to be the case. I always learn so much from Brian Koberlein and Roger Duby, and it's great fun for me. I want to stress again Alex's email. I take that point that we spend most of our time, we do talk about climate and the future of this planet, talking about climate, talking about what's going on here, preserving our planet. That should be the focus, but it's amazing to see what's out there. And Roger and Brian have reminded me to not close my imagination to what's possible. So see you guys on TRAPPIST, you know, one of the planets there. If we get there and it turns out there's other people there, there's like six other planets. So we'll just take a left turn, go hang out at another. We'll see how it goes. Brian Koberlein, always great fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Roger Duby, great fun. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Rob Braden and Megan Mack have been very patient with this hour because this is right in my sweet spot. A lot of fun. Thanks to them. Thank you for listening, and we will talk with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.